Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Many people will celebrate Friday as Cesar Chavez Day, which marks what would have been the iconic leader's 96th birthday. 30 years after his death, Chavez has cemented his legacy to the farm workers movement with strikes and a nonviolent approach in creating change for farm workers' rights. Yet, the deeper story of Cesar Chavez is much more complex and at times controversial. Some of his actions and his comments in the past would even be considered hardline conservative in today's politics. It's undeniable that his work helped advance the rights for so many people and gave Mexican Americans a symbol to look up to. Helping us unpack the legacy and the controversies behind the icon that is Cesar Chavez is Miriam Powell, who has written a biography on Cesar Chavez and reported extensively on the farm workers movement. Good morning, Miriam.
Hi, Vicky.
When did you first begin reporting and learning about the farm workers movement, in which culminated into multiple published books?
So I started reporting on the farm workers movement when I was a reporter at the Los Angeles Times in 2005. And I was specializing in reporting on agriculture in the state, which, of course, is a huge industry, and began to look at conditions for farm workers, which were still in many ways, as we're seeing today with some of the tragedies that have been unfolding with in climate change, that farm workers still lived in very difficult conditions, and was spending some time in camps in San Diego and began to look at what the UFW was doing. I was a baby boomer who grew up with the idea of boycotting grapes and had a as most people do, a very nebulous view of Cesar Chavez. I really didn't know much, and so started to look into what the union was doing and not doing and what it had become. And that kind of led me back in time to a look at both the remarkable movement that he created and all of the changes and things that happened in the 60s and 70s, and then sort of what happened to make that union not be a lasting force. And how do we get to the point today where studies say that, you know, statistically 0% of the farm workers in California are actually under union contracts.
Yeah, and we'll get into that in just a moment. When it comes to Cesar Chavez, I mean, in many ways, he's this iconic labor leader. What was most interesting and even challenging in learning more about the human, the person, Cesar Chavez?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think for me, doing the biography and learning about his childhood, his early years working in the fields, what that was like, what conditions were like that he grew up in, was really helpful in understanding what motivated him. And then also learning about sort of the 10 years that he spent learning to be a community organizer with a group called the Community Service Organization before he founded the UFW, was really instrumental to me in understanding sort of both his tactics, his strategies, sort of seeing how he developed. I mean, he didn't just spring full-born onto the cover of Time magazine in 1969. So all of that was fascinating. And then trying to unravel some of the things that went wrong in the end with the union and why, and understanding from his point of view why he made some of the decisions that he did. Mm-hmm.
Given that he was born in Yuma, Arizona in 1927 and had parents that were already with established roots in the region, how did that impact Cesar Chavez's view of undocumented migrants coming to the United States?
Well, I think it's important to put things in context of the time. And at that time, the difference between Mexicans and Mexican Americans was really significant in terms of how people viewed each other, viewed themselves, and in terms of identity. And also there's, you know, always an issue with strikes of being concerned about migrant, about scab labor. And the openness of the border at that point in time meant that growers could easily get workers to come across and break strikes. And that changed his, you know, as you said, he came from an established family. He was a Mexican American, and migrants who came from Mexico and went back and forth, which was relatively easy to do, you know, came to make money. And that becomes an issue for him because He's this very interesting and atypical labor leader who really didn't believe that workers should want to make too much money. They should want to sacrifice. They should have, you know, decent working conditions and be respected, but also sacrifice for the common good. So his feelings about migrants were very complicated.
Yeah, and the issues that he had with undocumented immigrants and migrants was also folded into the UFW movement. I think a lot of people would be surprised that, you know, he reported over 2,000 undocumented immigrants in Fresno to government officials, and that there was even a UFW, United Farm Workers Border Patrol group, right, that was placed along the Arizona border to prevent potential, as you say, scabbers from coming to America.
That's right. And there was violence, and there were things that really upset people at the time. There was something called the, quote, illegals campaign, in which everyone in the UFW who worked for the union, who were all volunteers, were basically directed to report undocumented immigrants to the INS because they were interfering with the allegation was that they were strike breakers. The truth is, it was, you know, it was much more complicated. There were a lot of undocumented workers then who were very loyal supporters of the UFW also. So the controversy over the illegals campaign was in sort of an early rupture in the union.
How should we view these actions that happened decades ago in today's time?
I think one has to sort of look at the context, the use of language, for example. I mean, there are people who have been very critical of him for using the word wetback. There were people at the time who objected to that, but on the whole, it was a much more commonly used word. So I do think that we have to look in context at we can't judge people solely by what they did by our standards, and yet we obviously also have to make those judgments in some ways.
Yeah, one of our producers actually found an interview with KQED in the 70s where Cesar Chavez refers to undocumented workers as illegals, or a term that you just said that can carry heavy pain for the Mexican-American community. You know, last year we spoke with Cesar Chavez's son, and we also interviewed Dolores Huerta in April, you know, ahead of her birthday. There mm-hmm. are other contributions of other farm worker leaders like Dolores Huerta, who has increasingly gained more attention and awareness. But decades after this movement and the attention that Cesar Chavez received, as well as Larry Itliong, and we also touched upon Philip Veracruz, the conversations about the farm workers movement often left out these critical leaders, at least decades ago. Why was it that Chavez was able to become this figure and this icon of a movement when there were other people who were critical to it?
I think that in some ways he deserves the reputation as the founder. I think that without him, this movement would not have happened. He was a very charismatic leader in his own way, in a very atypical way, because he was not a Kennedy-esque great speaker and visibly charismatic leader. But because of his brilliant strategy, and because of the fact that he walked the walk, he went to jail, he fasted, he was able to deliver and to show poor people that the poorest people in the state, you know, could, by banding together, take on the most powerful industry. And that got him the attention and deservedly so. On the other hand, you are absolutely right. I mean, there are, of course, a core of people, including Gilbert Padilla and others, who were there at the early at the earliest time, and his wife Helen Chavez as well, who were indispensable. And there are outside organizations who were indispensable, like the greater labor community, and in many ways the religious community also, who were able to provide that external support for things like the Great Boycott that enabled him to exert the kind of pressure that was needed in order to get reforms within the fields.
Why was there fallout between Chavez and some of the other founders like Larry Itliong or Philip Veracruz?
I think some of it had to do with differences in direction, and some of it had to do with Chavez's sort of increasingly, well, I would say from the beginning, need demand to be in control and to make decisions. And so as the organization got larger and larger and achieved these victories and won a law that allowed them to have elections and to win contracts for workers, the nature of the organization changed. And there are these agonizing discussions that I've listened to on tapes that he made of the internal meetings of the union, where they begin to have this deliberation of, are we a movement or are we a union? And we can't be both because we don't have the resources, we don't have the strength, we're not able to pull it together to both be a functional labor union in a more traditional sense, and then also be the movement. And for Chavez, the movement came first, and he makes that very, very clear. And that becomes something that comes at the cost of really being an effective union. And he begins to also then see people as being disloyal if they disagree with him or are trying to move the organization in a different direction. And there are a series of purges, and things begin to sort of fall apart as he loses control and is kind of unable to make that transition from being a movement to being a labor union.
What lasting legacy do you think that is left on the United Farm Workers and overall the movement?
I think he had this enormous impact on the Chicano movement at the time. That this idea that he showed what could be done by people who really had the least possible resources, that strategic brilliance and that example and those ways of community organizing became a lasting legacy that was carried on by a generation of people who came through the UFW, who were trained by him, who looked up to him as an inspiration. And in many ways, his legacy, you know, is not in the fields, it's in the cities and in places where this generation of leadership who were trained under him went on to work in other labor unions, in the environmental movement, and all sorts of social justice causes. So I think that's the most important legacy in many ways. And then again, and why I wrote the book, is that studying how he did this and both what went right and what went wrong, you know, is enormously inspirational and also I think useful for people who are interested in social justice and in figuring out, you know, how to change the world.
The United Farm Workers, UFW, I mean, they are still relevant today, especially when talking about the challenges that currently exist. They have a small membership. There were also significant victories that took place last year with Governor Newsom signing Assembly Bill 2183. We even had the UFW president, Teresa Romero, on Insight, who walked along the same path as Cesar Chavez during this more than like 300-mile pilgrimage to get that bill passed. If Cesar Chavez was alive today, what do you think he would do? And how do you think he would view the current struggles and also the progress that took place in the last year?
So I think it depends on which Cesar Chavez you're looking at in terms of whether you're looking at the younger Cesar Chavez or the older Cesar Chavez in some sense. And I would say that the Cesar Chavez, who I think is worth studying and important and heroic in his accomplishments, would want to go out and actually organize again, which is not something that's been happening in the fields, even though you're right, of course, that the law is now stronger and it makes it easier for the union to get elections, but they haven't been using the law that they had. So I think the question is sort of, you know, will the UFW return to its roots, which were really organizing in a very basic one-on-one way and showing workers what kind of strength they had by banding together? I think there's an open question as to whether they will do that in the way that he did in, you know, in his early years, or whether they will continue to be largely a political lobbying group, which may get some victories in the sort of the legislative arena. But, you know, Cesar Chavez often said that he did not want to depend on the state or on politicians or elected officials to do things, that the strongest way to make change was to have the people who were really affected by it organize themselves and force that change. So it has to come from the ground up. And that's something that, you know, that we have not been seeing happen. So the question is sort of, will there be more top-down change or will there be a return to that sort of grassroots organizing?
Mm. Finally, Miriam, I mean, you have this unparalleled view of Cesar Chavez, given the years of research that you have done. What was the most surprising thing you learned about Cesar Chavez that doesn't come to the front of our collective minds?
I think that's a hard question for me. I think that just his complexity, I don't think that I would say it was surprising, but I think that the more that I learned about him and studied him and researched and talked to people, you know, I got into this because the movement that he led was such a profoundly transformational experience for everyone I met who had been involved in it. And I wanted to understand what that was about. You know, I don't think we've seen a movement of that power in a long time. So I wanted to understand that. And then I think I ultimately came to understand why it was that he, in essence, abandoned the union in some ways in order to try to preserve that. And I always sort of talk about him as a heroic figure in the Greek definition of the word hero. Our word hero comes from the Greek definition, which is the marriage of a mortal and a god. And from the godlike parent, they derive that superhuman strength that they have. And that was really interesting to me to understand what his superhuman strength was. What was his superpower? And then from their mortal parent, they inherit their tragic flaws. And understanding how those two come together in one person, I think, you know, it should increase our appreciation of their heroism and their humanity.
Miriam, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Happy Cesar Chavez Day.
Yes, and so interesting. An interesting way to start ahead of the holiday. Miriam Powell is a biographer of Cesar Chavez and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Cooking is culture, and a crucial piece to how we enjoy food are stoves. There is a heated debate, pun intended, taking place within California's broad climate goals. As the state works to reach carbon neutrality in the coming decades, it's finding ways to cut emissions in many parts of life. That includes the kitchen. And that also includes transitioning to all electric appliances by 2045, so within the next 20 years or so. However, gas stoves are a centerpiece of cooking styles across the world, from tortillas to naan, blistering vegetables, wok stir fries. Cooking over a flame touches many cultures. And there's criticism that electric stoves simply don't cut it. Manola Sakaira is CAP Radio's environment reporter and joins us with how one kitchen appliance impacts California's energy future. Good morning, Manola.
Good morning. I love a good punny story.
Yes, I know. We did a lot of them with this segment. And you and I touched upon this briefly when you joined us, you know, a month or two ago. And now you're diving into it. What excited you about diving into really a very specific debate about a single household appliance when it comes to California's energy future and the environment, which is your wheelhouse?
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, it's a story I've been thinking about for a while, but I know a lot of people have been thinking about it. It's a lot over the news. I see a lot of angry tweets about this, too. There's obviously a lot of interest in this topic about gas stovetops, moving away from them. What does that mean? And like you mentioned, it's something that came up in a story for me previously. That's kind of when I started thinking about specifically the cultural cooking component behind it. So basically, I was working on a story about an electrification program here in Sacramento, and I noticed that a lot of residents and the people, you know, running the program noticed that a lot of Latino residents specifically said that they didn't want to swap out some utilities because of, you know, cultural cooking related reasons. So I remember talking to one woman who just mentioned that, you know, it would just change some things for her. She didn't go into too much detail, but I was really curious, you know, as to why that was and if it was a larger phenomenon. And then it turned out, you know, yeah, there was something behind that. So I was curious about learning more.
Yep. I've had those debates within even my own friend and family group as well. So what is California actually proposing when it comes to phasing out gas stoves?
Right. So it's obviously important to understand that, too, because I know there's a lot of anxiety around this conversation, but no one's coming to take anyone's gas stoves right now. So that's the first thing to know. But obviously, there are some changes coming. So California has a climate change scoping plan that lays out all these steps the state wants to take to reaching carbon neutrality by 2045. And there's a lot of different components to that. Electrification is a big component. So thinking about electrifying cars and trucks and also buildings. And then, you know, in buildings, that's including appliances. So there's a desire as part of this plan to move away from utilities that emit pollutants at home. And in that scoping plan, California set a target for new residential appliance sales, aiming for them to be all electric by 2035. So that could include stoves. And talk about that, of course, has sparked a lot of debate. So I talked to Matt Botil. He works for the California Air Resources Board and told me a little bit more about the state's thinking behind this decision.
So it does play an important role in reducing our reliance on fossil gas. And with it comes the greenhouse gas benefits, but also the indoor air quality benefits and the outdoor air pollution reduction benefits that come from cutting combustion more broadly.
Yeah. And he also told me there's some health benefits to cutting emissions, which could lead to health savings. So he sees a lot of, you know, ripple effects coming out of this. And then on a more local level, cities are also approaching electrification in different ways. I think there's, you know, dozens of cities throughout the state that have passed their own electrification ordinances, and Sacramento is one of them. Here, where we passed an electrification ordinance that looks at electrifying new buildings. And there are some exemptions in that. So that could be exemptions for buildings where a restaurant might be housed, allowing them to have some non-electric utilities in the kitchen. So it's not a total eradication, like by any means. That's not happening anytime soon. But you can see where the general direction is going to cutting emissions that way.
So given that cities like Sacramento, they're already getting a head start with an electrification ordinance, how are they navigating all of this?
Yeah, I talked to Councilmember Katie Valenzuela about that. She's been working with the city on electrification and also just does a lot of statewide work related to this. And she told me about some of the issues with making that happen.
I mean, the barriers to transition are really deep. You know, a lot of cultural cooking wasn't taught using a recipe card, right? You know, I learned how to make my grandma's tortilla recipe through very not scientific methods of this much salt in the palm of your hand, right? This much shortening until it feels this way. So there's a concern about how do you adapt those practices that were passed down from prior generations to this new technology, and how do we learn to do that in a way that gives us the same outcome and that same feeling of family and tradition on a new appliance?
Yeah, so it really just speaks to the fact that we can't just come at this from a purely technical perspective. I mean, there's a lot of technical questions mm-hmm. behind this transition, too. But this is also a cultural shift. And, you know, she kind of recognized that and said that there was more work to be done in that regard.
Yeah, and culture isn't technical, right? And mm-hmm. cooking is a part of culture, and stoves are a crucial piece to all of this. So what did you learn about the cultural challenges transitioning away from gas and into electric stoves?
Yeah, I got to talk to some chefs about that, which was really interesting. And a lot of what I heard was just about different cultural styles and how some have adapted to, you know, a flame, having an open flame being part of that cooking. You know, that can be when you're charring something like for salsas or cooking something quickly at high heat. And I talked to Chef David Suhu about that. He's a Cantonese chef who's owned a huge number of restaurants over the years in Sacramento. He even told me he used to cook for Paris Hilton's grandpa, but that's a whole different story.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. So he's a good chef.
You
really
should
good
have a
chef.
Biography as well.
But yes, he's a professional chef who's looked at a lot of different types of cuisines, including cooking from his own culture. And he told me that in a lot of places, dishes are designed with the quick cooking of, you know, that comes with the heat of a fire in mind.
That's perfect for Western cooking, European cooking, because you're working with butter and you're working with sauces. So you don't need that much heat. And you might be making a stock, which is overnight. And super low heat. But if you're going to cook ethnic cuisine, then you need the vegetables and the meats are usually cut, and even the breads are flat. And this way, you have more surface.
Yeah, and we talked about some Latin American dishes, for example, where you cut meats up really small, veggies up really small, and those meats cook and the veggies cook really quickly. And again, that's with like really quick heat versus, like he said, some European styles of cooking that don't need as much intense heat. You know, think like a really thick steak. You're not going to try to burn that with like super high heat right away. It'll just take a different style of cooking. You're not trying to cook it all the way through. So it's a cultural shift for people whose everyday dishes are these kinds of dishes. Moving to electric stovetop could mean different pans they're not familiar with, or adapted cooking styles. And that's not to say that electric stovetops are inherently slower or burn slower or heat up slower. Over the years, there's been a lot of progress when it comes to electric stovetops. So, you know, the problems from a few decades ago are different now. But even then, they distribute heat differently. You know, thinking of a wok, which Chef David Suhu and I talked a little bit about, it's just not the same when there's not those flames kind of creeping up along the sides of that pan anymore. So that's one example of what the differences could look like. And David told me about his own story, which kind of illustrates these problems in the transition, at least the way he's seen it.
Given that he has obviously extensive experience in the kitchen and with restaurants, how is he figuring out a transition away from gas?
Yeah, he had a really interesting story that he shared with me, and it goes way back. So when he was growing up, his dad owned a Chinese restaurant here in Sacramento, where they did a lot of cooking in a wok. Basically, when his dad would come home, they didn't have a burner that was hot enough to cook food in a wok, which typically, you know, requires that open flame. The shape of the dish is also built in a way where the flames can climb up and heat the sides, like I mentioned, which is something that an electric stovetop can't accomplish the same way. So at the time, you know, this was decades ago, his dad had to come up with his own solution.
So the struggle among the Chinese community has always been, we complain and say we can't cook properly because we don't have the heat. But you adapt. In other words, that's the best you can do. So the people who were in the restaurant business, of course, we had these incredible gas burners. And the only way you can do it at home was to do it in your garage. So when your water heater broke, you simply take a big saw. You chop off half of it. So you add this gas water heater with a thermostat. And then you put your wok in there, you can do everything a restaurant can do.
That sounds safe.
Yeah.
He's very experienced.
I wouldn't recommend it. And he also has a lot of technical experience with these things. And that's also his dad,
right.
You know?
Right.
But there is more to the story. And there's more to how he figured it out for himself, too. So later in the 80s, as he was a professional chef, he started seeing electric woks being sold in places like Macy's. So they're becoming a little bit more mainstream, at least with, you know, non-Asian American audiences. And people outside of his own community were trying out wok cooking kind of on a bigger scale. But, you know, that Macy's electric wok wasn't designed by Chinese chefs who have the knowledge of the cuisine like people like David do. It would shut off at a certain temperature for safety reasons that was much lower than what wok cooking requires. So David had to come up with his own solution again. He shorted it out, basically, so that it could get to a higher temperature than its design originally intended. And again, David's been trained on this, on these kinds of appliances on a more technical level. I'm not recommending that people go short out their appliances at home. But I think what we can learn from this story is that it really shows the lengths that a person in David's position is, you know, forced to go through in order to accomplish their culture's cooking style in a place where technologies aren't made for, you know, with their communities in mind.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of adapting that goes along, that goes with it. And as we learned with an electric wok, you know, it made a style of cooking just not really possible its traditional sense. I mean, he wasn't the only chef you talked to. What did other chefs tell you about potentially transitioning away from gas stoves?
Yeah. So there was a kind of a difference that I, you know, in writing the story ended up piecing, you know, kind of separating a little bit. So there's the home cooking side of it. And, you know, David was speaking a little bit to that. And then there's the restaurant cooking side of it. So I also talked to Billy Ngo, who owns Crew and a few other restaurants here in Sacramento. Crew is a sushi focused restaurant, but does also do hot dishes. And he told me that hot dishes kind of help bridge the financial gap for them in the winter. So, you know, it's really important when people aren't buying as much sushi. And when he thinks about this transition, and this is not like he's not the only restaurant owner who thinks about it this way. He says that electric stovetops, you know, it's harder to keep them on and working for creating the amount of food that they need to for, you know, the number of people that come into the restaurant.
And hours on end. Yeah,
for hours on end. And that's not really a problem that has been totally solved just yet. And then he also kind of told me that he has concerns about, you know, blackouts in the summer and how that would affect an all-electric kitchen. So it's obvious that there are still a lot of questions when it comes to restaurants in this transition. And that's why some of these electrification ordinances have those exemptions that are kind of tailored around restaurants. Yeah, so there's some more questions there, it seems like.
Yeah, so it's still developing and evolving. There's more conversations taking place. But at the center of this, whether it's in a home kitchen or in a restaurant, like we're getting to equity, right? Because we're talking about food from different cultures all over the world. So how should we go about this transition to electric?
Mm-hmm. A key thing here is that this is kind of an inevitable transition, at least in California to a large extent. You know, not to say that there's not going to be any place for gas appliances in the future, but obviously there's all these efforts to phase them out. And as the state phases these appliances out, that has bigger implications. And then also, I guess, taking a step back, there's all the research around gas stoves that show that they do pose a health risk to people. They're often one of the primary sources of indoor air pollution at home. And then communities of color are already more likely to be impacted by air pollutants. So it's kind of like a compounding thing. And that just leaves us with the fact that as we transition to electric, that might mean aging gas infrastructure becomes less reliable for the people that depend on it. That's why, you know, Katie Valenzuela, the Sacramento City Council member I talked to, told me it's important we don't leave people behind.
But then what we're doing is we're putting the onus on that household to figure that out in the future. And that's not equitable either. Those households need the full breadth and depth of tools. And that means that we as government need to figure out how to approach those households with everything that they're going to need. And we're not doing that right now.
She told me that she wants electrification programs to focus on how we can get everyone on board with this transition and take their concerns into account when we're trying to make these plans.
Yeah. So how do we make it equitable?
Right. I think a key thing here is acknowledging that there are some real and valid concerns present for some of the people that are, you know, kind of resistant of this transition. Obviously, there's a lot more than that. It's a huge political thing. Gas companies have played a big part in making gas stoves popular. I mean, if you look back historically, there was a time where electric stovetops were the majority, and then that switched. So there's a whole story behind that, too, a whole different story about how gas companies have pushed that forward. But it, you know, goes to show that I think sometimes there's skepticism of anti-gas stove skepticism, and there's a reason for that. But then there are people like David, you know, who've had their own journey that really reveals the blind spots that can exist in this transition. So it tells me that when it comes to things as fundamental as the way we're creating cooking equipment, we have to include the voices and perspectives that, you know, people that are going to be using these technologies. So an equitable transition would mean including those perspectives, taking the time to address those concerns. And it's going to take a lot of work. But it's, again, really inevitable work that we need to start doing soon to make sure we get on this journey together.
Yeah. I mean, you bring up a good point. When I learned a lot from your reporting, especially the fact that you bring up that electric appliances or stoves actually used to be common and then it went back to gas stoves. Is this uniquely a California issue? How do gas stoves in California stack up to the rest of the country?
I was interested in that, too, and I couldn't find a complete answer with this. But what I do know is that a 2020 survey told me that 70% in California of households use gas stoves in this state. And it's a number that's a lot higher than the nationwide average of 38%. So it seems like there are some places where gas stoves are just a lot more popular. And I hope I can kind of learn a little bit more about that, too, because it's really interesting.
It is just beginning for you.
This isn't over yet.
Thank you so much, Manola.
Thanks for having me.
Manola Sakaita is Cap Radio's environment reporter, explaining the debate between gas and electric stoves and how this all fits into California's energy goals. Up next, we're going to introduce you to Mid-Pacific. It is Cap Radio's latest podcast. It is dropping today, exploring what it means to be Asian American. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Today is a big day. Cap Radio is dropping a brand new podcast. Mid-Pacific asks what it means to be Asian American and really the feeling of being caught between two worlds through food, politics, family, and so much more. This 6-episode exploration reveals that that is a loaded question with a lot of different answers. Cap Radio's race and equity reporter, Sarah Mises-Tan, is the host of Mid-Pacific. New episodes drop every Thursday. The first one just dropped today. Sarah, welcome and congratulations.
Thank you so much, Vicky.
So this podcast really takes on what it means to be Asian American, and that can obviously take on a plethora of different meanings. But what I found so interesting and wonderful was that, you know, typically as journalists, our personal journeys typically are left out of our work. But this was different for you in a sense. And it's kind of this culmination of navigating what it means to be Asian American yourself. So let's start with your background and your family.
Totally. Yeah. So for folks, I guess, who will learn very soon, who listened to episode one of our podcast, my family is maybe not unlike many other Asian American families, honestly. They have truly embraced a lot of American culture in an effort to fully assimilate. This is my grandfather singing his very favorite song.
Oh, say, can you see? By the dawn's early light, was so proud we hailed at the twilight last gleaming.
So, yes, he sings that song every year on his birthday. He is so proud to be an American, you know? And I think I really like this clip just because I think it really It really illustrates that in-between space that I think a lot of us Asian Americans inhabit, including my grandfather, whether or not he would admit it. You know, when you hear him singing that, you know that he is not born in this country. He doesn't sound, he's got a Korean accent. He's from Korea. And his English is not perfect when he speaks. But at the same time, if you were to ask him actually what he thought that he identified as, he would actually say American. And he's incredibly proud to be American. And I just thought that that was such an interesting place to start from, because we've got him on one hand and a lot of my family on one hand kind of saying, we're American, we're American. And then I kind of, as someone who was born in this country, I have kind of grown up in a system where at home people are telling me I'm American, but actually at school and in like other places, a lot of people would look at me and say, well, a lot of people look at me and ask, where are you from? You know,
right.
And I'm like, well, that's confusing because I'm from here, I guess, or I everyone at home tells me I'm an American, but I am supposed to give you a different answer here. And I think that's kind of like that really interesting in-between space that a lot of us Asian Americans inhabit.
Oh, absolutely. And it transcends and even can be different depending on the generation as well, right? So given that this has been your experience really since you were a child, when did the idea for Mid-Pacific begin to take shape for you as a journalist?
Totally, yes. So I actually have been thinking about doing a podcast exploring Asian American identity since before starting at CAP Radio. But I think this idea really got some momentum behind it after the George Floyd demonstrations, where I heard a lot of other Asian American folks actually kind of questioning where they sat in that black and white American system, because I think that whole event kind of brought forward this larger system of racism, and Asian Americans stepped back and we were like, well, we're not white, but we're not black. Where are we? Kind of this, that question started to come up. I started to hear it a lot in my like Asian American friends kind of asking. And then I think obviously it really got hit home the following year with the Georgia Spa shooting, and then Asian Americans really kind of feeling put on the outside with being blamed for the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, from the first episode, your podcast really gets you thinking, whether Asian American or not. I mean, even if you're the descendant of immigrants or indigenous to this land, I mean, right off the bat, the wheels start turning and you start learning how individual and nuanced this is. And I think one of the best ways to explain what I'm getting at is listening to the part where you ask Asian Americans how they define themselves.
Hi, my name is Ruby from the Bay Area. Identify as South Asian. Both my parents immigrated here from India, and I have always thought about my Indian identity first, actually, even though I'm born and raised in America.
Hi, I'm Jessica Chang, Irish, and I identify as ABC, which is American-born Chinese.
My name is Ryan Liu. So I generally identify with being Cantonese, but I also identify with being an Angeleno, being a native of LA, being a native Californian. And, you know, sometimes, depending on the news of the day, yes, I'm an American, too.
Yeah, that really, like, for me, I was like, whoa. So I'm like, so I'm mixed race, right? So when I listened to that for the first time, I thought, wow, I've never really asked myself that question, nor would I know how my own parents would respond. I mean, my mom is Japanese and English. My dad is Mexican. They both immigrated here as children. And I had that conversation with them, thanks to you, Sarah, because I learned a great deal about my parents, which is pretty funny because I felt like I'm really close to them, but I learned so much more. And I think that really just illustrates how often we can overlook these really meaningful conversations that can reveal a great deal about someone. When listening to the varying ways that Asian Americans identified themselves, when you were taking this all in, what was the bigger message for you?
You know, I really enjoy, in a way, that being Asian American is a complex identity, like many other identities. Some people don't like to be called Asian American. Some people, like myself, find it to be the best descriptor of their own background. And a lot of other folks just feel like it doesn't mean anything at all. But I wanted to explore some topics of connection that show their similarities that will come through if you identify or if you are identified under this term. I think whether you're Indian American, Chinese American, or however you identify yourself as an Asian American generally, there are similar threads. There's going to be that familiarity with an immigration experience, even if you yourself are not an immigrant. There's an understanding of what it means to bridge two cultures and to not really be accepted into either. And I want our podcast to celebrate this in-betweenness in a way, because I think that can actually really be a strength.
Yeah. How did you land on the name Mid-Pacific?
Yeah, super interesting. So Mid-Pacific is actually a term that I first heard used in reference to Bruce Lee, actor, obviously, does not need explanation, hopefully. But I was watching a documentary about his life, and someone mentioned that a film critic had once referred to Bruce Lee as a Mid-Pacific man. And for those who don't know, Bruce Lee was born in San Francisco, but his family moved to Hong Kong shortly afterwards. And he spent a lot of his career kind of trying to break into the American film market and also the Chinese film market. And in neither places was he accepted as being kind of a native there. In the American film market, he was seen as an Asian actor. And in the Asian film market, he was seen as an American actor. So a film critic kind of said, you know what? Bruce Lee is a mid-Pacific man. And that's kind of, you know, I don't know how the film critic meant it. I don't know if he maybe meant it in a bad way. But I liked the term just because it really, I felt it really illustrated that in-betweenness that I feel. And also I liked that because our podcast is rooted in California, it kind of feels like California-ish, West Coast-ish.
Given that there are just 6 episodes, I mean, you can go in so many directions with this. Lay out the journey that you're taking listeners on.
Yeah. So I think we kind of start from the basic building blocks. I wanted folks to get a chance to identify themselves, as you heard, so on their own terms, and kind of just like play around with this term. Like, what is Asian American? I found a lot of people didn't know that it's a term that has its own history, as you will hear in the episode. I won't get into that here. But, you know, after that, after we kind of lay the groundwork for this term Asian American, I wanted to just like dive into some history, show people that there are deep roots of Asian American and Asian America in this country. And then we kind of just like stem out into topics that I have had conversations about with my own friends and family that tend to be common connectors for the Asian American community. So talking about like food, even though you may not speak a language or you may not be from that country, food can be a powerful connector. Talking about mental health, talking about representation in politics.
Yeah. Given that you spent like about a year listening and learning from others, those are a lot of conversations, but also you open up and you share parts of your life. When you reflect on this time, what moments really stay with you?
Oh, I think it's just been hearing the variety of people use the term Asian American and kind of like roll it over in their head. It's not something that I often get to ask people. So it's a real privilege to be able to take so much time to just ask them like, well, what does that mean to you? I think that it's just not part of our conversation. You know, one person in particular who really struck me in what he had to say about his feeling about Asian Americans' roots in this country was Assemblymember Alex Lee. He's one of the youngest assembly members in California, and he represents San Jose, which is one of the most Asian American districts in California.
We have, for the history of Asian Americans, ever since we touched these shores, one way or the other, is like that we were punished for being different, right? I mean, we were, as Chinese Americans, the only ones that are excluded by race in the law. But I think it's that drive to assimilate to survive and that proximity to whiteness has always been used against us to wedge us against other communities of color. So I think that experience manifests itself differently amongst Asian American families, but I think that largely is why we like to think that our experience is neutral, but in fact there is an Asian American coloring lens.
Yeah, I think that right there is why it has been so interesting for me to talk to Asian Americans of all generations, all different backgrounds, just because Asian Americans, I think typically we do tend to kind of want to just assimilate or blend into the background and say we're not really a race, but we obviously are. There is obviously a coloring to the way we look at the world. And I love being able, it was a real privilege to be able to elevate that for a little bit.
We also can't ignore the timing of your podcast. This comes during a rise in hate crimes against the AAPI community, Asian American Pacific Islanders, mass shootings at the beginning of the year in California within the AAPI community. But then there's also these long overdue cultural successes in recent years. I mean, obviously the Oscars with Everything Everywhere All at Once. I think of Squid Games on Netflix. I mean, even a couple years ago, the movie Parasite, K-pop like BTS, and also comedy specials. There's more and more comedians that you can see on HBO or another streaming channels. That's personally my favorite, on and on and on. So how does the podcast acknowledge all of this, like taking this all in together, both the trauma and also the long overdue celebrations?
Totally. You know, I think I don't want our podcast to feel like we're telling people what to think about these things, but I did want our podcast to kind of open up the conversation. So I think that's what I hope that we do, especially in our first few episodes where we just kind of reference these things. We reference like how they have typically made me feel or made other Asian Americans feel. And I would like people to kind of explore within themselves like, oh, yeah, I didn't think about it that way before, something like that. And, you know, I will say I do hope that listeners generally will kind of take this podcast into context today as well. Like, yes, there have been all those things that have happened over the past few years that makes this relevant. But also, you know, I, as an Asian American, feel nervous when I see the news right now. There's obviously been a cooling of relations between the U.S. and China. And I don't think I'm alone in being concerned about how this will impact Asian Americans here in this country and how non-Asian Americans are going to view us in this time of tumult. So I really hope that people will use this podcast as a bit of a touchstone.
Ocean Vuong says this really beautiful line in his book, On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous. He writes, because the sunset, like survival, exists only on the verge of its own disappearing, to be gorgeous, you must first be seen, but to be seen allows you to be hunted. And I think we've been trying to fight for our visibility, to be seen, to be called Asian American, or to proudly proclaim this identity of Asian American, but it also in a way puts the target on our back, right? Sadly. And I hope, for me, being anything, being a human being, being Asian American, being Vietnamese, being American, it's all a journey, right? We have to always recognize that fluidity and that evolution of identity. Otherwise, we'll get stuck in many ways and not be able to define who we are on our own terms.
And that beautiful quote is from Bao Wen. He is the director of the movie about Bruce Lee's life, Be Water, if you're interested in watching it, that inspired this.
That is a perfect way to end our conversation. Sarah, thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you, Vicky.
And that is CAP Radio race and equity reporter Sarah Mises-Tan, who just launched a new podcast today. You can listen to Mid-Pacific wherever you get your podcasts. We also have a link on our Insight page. New episodes drop every Thursday. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.